coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody. Happy Tuesday night. Howdy out there to our good friends, Seb Talk and Earl Grey. Man, I'm so proud of them and happy for them. They are out there right now as we speak live on the MUFON Speaks podcast. Make sure to check them out, folks. By all means, check them out in replay format. Seriously, though, they are fantastic and good friends of the show. I am so happy, so proud for them. I cannot wait for us to do our dual coverage of MUFON Symposium this year. It's going to be so fantastic. We have some great guests for you tonight. In our second segment, we have our good friend Jason Quitt. His new book, Gates of the Anunnaki, is out. He's actively working on a new book as we speak. That is what I love about him, is that as he goes through a topic and starts writing, like, his new book is based on an entire chapter of another book that he wrote. He was like, I was in the middle of writing it, and there was just too much for this chapter. Then it ended up fleshing out into a whole book. So his work is amazing. He goes through ancient civilizations, how their esoteric knowledge has been passed down through the generations onto modern time, and how we may not even be aware of it. So stop on by and check him out. We will be joined by him in our second half of the broadcast. I officially just received my first edition of the Shakespeare Oxford newsletter. I am now officially a member of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship. We will be going this summer in September to cover the Shakespeare Authorship Controversy Conference in Denver, Colorado. And I cannot tell you how much I am looking forward to that, folks. I was quite literally shooting interviews for the 50th anniversary of my high school, taping down cables in the first place I ever taped cables. And I got the text message from them like, hey, congratulations, the panel has reviewed your proposal and we would love to have you come do coverage. So it was very serendipitous to get a message about covering Shakespeare while I was in the theater. So stay tuned for that coverage this year, folks. It's going to be fantastic. Thank you so much to our good guest, Catherine Children, for helping make those connections happen. Margie Kay is our guest in this first segment. She is the author of Gateway to the Dead. She is also the author of Winged Aliens. Well, it went off the page, but Winged Aliens, as well as many other books. Welcome to the show, Margie Kay. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So pardon me as I throw your digital book around my studio.
It just flew out of your hand.
It did. So, well, you have been in the world of paranormal investigation for years. And speaking of somebody who has a voluminous amount of books, you yourself are a regular writer and releaser. How long have you been in the world of paranormal research, Margie?
About 40 years.
Wow.
Probably a little before that, but I'd be revealing my age if I told you exactly. I got really interested at a very young age because some strange things happened to me. So I went down the rabbit hole and I haven't gotten out yet.
Well, and you need so much in the rabbit hole that you've actually helped found the UnX Network. You have UnX Magazine. This is a full-time pursuit for you. It's not like some weekend warrior action. So,
started out that way, but it's definitely full-time.
It's very easy for it to become an all-consuming passion. Even most of my time outside of my family is spent just cramming research into my head and reading things and watching shows and listening to interviews. And, some of your stuff, especially Winged Aliens, is really amazing. Let's start kind of cracking the nut a little bit about the paranormal and some of the research that you have done, Margie.
Okay. Well, like I said earlier, I got interested in the paranormal at a young age. And by about age 10 or 11, I had realized that I was psychic. Well, I mean, the whole family knew that from the time I was like two. And I decided to investigate it. And I started going to the library and checking out as many books as they would allow every month. And it was all on the occult and psychics, ESP, Edgar Casey, you know, the gamut. And then one thing would lead to another, would lead to another, until finally you can't stop. We're talking about all different subjects. And I believe all of these things are related as well. And you can't just say down one aisle, say, for instance, UFOs in one and then cryptids in another and interdimensional beings, cryptids and, you know, winged cryptids, of course. It's all connected. And what the thing that connects it all is consciousness. So I've come to realize that your particular level of consciousness is what is going to allow you to have different experiences with interdimensional beings and beings and entities that have a level of consciousness equal to yours or higher, but you're at least able to communicate at a certain point.
Interesting, because we on the show regularly, Margie, I will state, I fully believe in the existence of extraterrestrial beings. I fully believe in the existence of interdimensional beings, Sasquatch. I believe that there is a large hominid species roaming the woods of North America. However, I also believe that there is something else out there that is willing to use the tropes of our mind that we are comfortable with to expose itself to us. You know, whether it be the fact of like, you're out in the woods and you'd be comfortable seeing a Sasquatch, so that's what pops out of that portal for you. You know?
Yeah.
And that's just where I lie with it from the research I've done, things like that, is that there is something else there that is kind of using the tropes of our mind as a form of consent to appear to us.
That, and when they see your vibration or your vibratory rate, then they'll know when it's time to let themselves be known to you. For instance, I had an extraordinary event in 1985 when Valiant Thor appeared to me while I was at a massage therapist, and his head appeared to me on the wall and he spoke to me, but no one else heard it or saw it that was with me.
What did Valiant Thor say to you?
He said, first of all, he took over my massage therapist because my massage therapist suddenly turns to me as I'm getting ready to leave, putting on our coats. He says, would you like to try a light experiment? And I knew it wasn't his voice. And I knew something was up. You know, my spidey sense went off. And I said, yeah, sure, I'd like to try that. And so he had me look at a green light and then a red light back and forth for a couple of minutes. And then he said, now, what do you see? And still in that other voice. And I look up and I see only his skeleton standing there. Nothing else. Just his skeleton. And I'm trying to process this for a few seconds when all of a sudden to my right, a voice talks. And I look to my right and I see the head on the wall. And he said, I am Thor. And now you have X-ray vision. And he says, I'll be in touch with you. We're going to be working together. And he was gone. And everything was back to normal. And I looked at my brother and my children and massage therapist. I said, what did you guys see that? Did you hear that? And they're like, what? We didn't see a thing.
Wow.
And I didn't know who Thor was at that time at all. But I would come to learn, because I was doing psychic readings for people. And I would come to find out what that meant. And that meant that I could see inside the human body, and I would find areas that had problems, help do a diagnosis of issues and let people know if they needed to see a physician or seek medical help. And in some cases, just tell them that something, you know, that they thought was wrong wasn't, because I didn't see it there. And so that has, that ability has increased over the years. And Thor has stayed with me over the years, usually just telepathic communication, but he has appeared to me on several occasions during that time. And I visit his craft in my astral body.
Wow.
On several occasions.
And what has that experience been like being aboard his craft, Margie?
Just the most amazing thing ever. It's what it looks like on the inside is mostly this silver colored metal in most places, but it's still beautiful in there. He's showed me the upper, very, very upper deck is all a greenhouse. So that's where their food is grown, in this upper deck. And they get sunlight through the top of the craft, which, by the way, is in a bubble that it envelops it. And so it's invisible to anybody that's just driving by. They wouldn't see it. And then the different, they showed me the room where their propulsion system is. And they explained a little bit about the propulsion system to me, how it uses negative ions. It's called an ion anti-gravity system. And they showed me a vision of when they turn it on, actually the person who runs that room, the engine room, it is a woman, and she took me on this tour. And so there's a railing around this big circle, and you look down the circle and the engine is below it, but the craft, you can see the ground underneath it. And then you, we look up, you can see the sky because it's open in the top and the bottom of the craft.
Oh, wow.
And so this energy, once it's turned on, it envelops the craft, and it's a magnetic energy because it goes above and below, and then it encircles the entire craft. But they told me that what happens when they turn that on, because this is their main propulsion system for space, when they are not, I'm sorry, this is for when they're close to a planet. When they're in space, they use a different one.
Okay.
So they have to use two different propulsion systems. Anyway, when this one is on, it also has, it creates photons. So that's why you see light around some of these craft. You just see a light flying through the sky that's a craft. And it's because they're using that type of propulsion system. They cannot hide that. They can't hide that light part.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that is something that we've discussed regularly on the show, especially once you start dealing with high order electromagnetic fields, things like that, high order plasmic fields, which if you're bending space, time, things like that, you would have to be using some technology similar to that. Those do off-put light. Those do operate within a very specific frequency range. And one of the ideas that I've proffered is the idea that experiencers of that, specifically, Margie, those who have been aboard craft, those who have been in proximity of craft, are very much affected the same way that an analog watch is affected by being near a magnet. Where that watch will always be partially magnetized. It will always tell time in a different way, you know, because of the vibrational field that it has been exposed to. It's very interesting to see the number of people who do come back from experiences, either with new psychic gifts or with increased psychic gifts. Did you find, now, how old were you? Because, of course, you said that you'd had psychic experiences when you were a child. How old were you when you first met Thor?
Well, let's see.
And how long had you been having
I was 29.
Psychic experiences? How long
I
had
was
you been
29, yeah. And I'd been having... I mean, we knew by the time I was two that I was very psychic.
Oh, wow.
But what he did was increase that exponentially. So I can see inside people or animals or inside buildings or machinery, cars, can, you know, find where a problem is with a vehicle. I may not know what I'm looking at, but I can describe it, and then someone else can go fix it. It's the same thing with the human body. I might not know exactly what it is, but there are some things that have also happened in the last few years where I will communicate directly with an organ that has a consciousness and will speak to me directly.
Interesting. And how does that conversation happen for you? I mean, is it a conversation of impression, kind of in the sense of a remote viewing session? Is it in the sense of a telepathic form of communication or conversation? How does that happen for you?
It's both. I'll remote view it. I'll see it, and I will see what it looks like. For instance, if what I see a lot is a slightly enlarged liver with stones in it, and I'll see that, and then the liver will telepathically communicate and tell me what the problem is and what needs to be done about it. So I will make some suggestions. And of course, since I'm not a licensed professional, I always say this is for entertainment only. And the person needs to just take what they want from that reading session and either take care of it themselves. Sometimes it's a very minor thing, or they need to see, you know, a physician. And sometimes I see things that are urgent.
Sure.
And I'll tell them. I don't sugarcoat things when I do readings, by the way. I will just tell people the truth about everything, because I feel like there's a reason why they've come to me and they need answers, and I'm just going to tell them what I see.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those, especially with what you're dealing with and the way it comes in, it's hard to sugarcoat that. Because truths are hard, you know?
Yeah.
And they can be hard to deal with, but they're kind of supposed to be. Now, with that in mind, many people who have psychic abilities, who are transmedium, medium, things like that, Margie, have numerous spiritual guides. Obviously, Valiant Thor is one for you. How many spiritual guides are you aware of that you have?
Oh, at least 11, but they come and go.
Okay.
They'll show up when I need them. For instance, I've got one guide named White Cloud, and he was actually the first one I met. My grandfather contacted me in the year 2021. Yeah, 21. Mm. I was in a dead sleep, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, I hear my grandfather's voice. So he'd been dead since 1972. And even though I am a medium and I've contacted loved ones who passed over for other people for years, I could never get in touch with him. And it always bothered me. Well, I heard his Brooklyn Italian accent, you know, and he says, "Maggie, get up." And I'm like, "Oh, what?" And I sat up in bed. I said, "No, I did not just hear that." And I started to lie back down. He says, "Maggie, get up and go down to the computer in your office." And so I said, "Okay." So 3 o'clock in the morning, I get up, I go down, and he speaks to me, and I just kind of did automatic typing, which I didn't know I could do. Mm. And because I couldn't really remember everything he was saying to me, I was in like a trance state.
Okay.
And typed up 3 pages of stuff for the family and also coming events for the world, things like that. And then he came back to me a few days later and he introduced me to a spirit, Native American by the name of White Cloud. And then I was told the whole story about how we had spent several lifetimes together, and I was a shaman with him. He trained me, and then I became Medicine Woman. And I said, "Wait a minute, I've seen Medicine Woman. And what's medicine woman showed up when I was visiting a massage therapist one time, and I saw her standing next to him, and I said, "Who's that Native American lady with the long white hair wearing a blue dress?" He says, "Oh, you can see her? That's medicine woman."
Oh,
and
wow.
She comes in to help me sometimes. Well, come to find out, and then she helps me when I'm doing work on people. I'll do some Reiki healing on people, and she'll show up. But she is me. So try to wrap your head around that one.
That is
because I still can't.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's you from a previous life.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That is, and you know, I've been through regression a couple of times. I actually just went through a regression session, with some of the strangest results I've had yet. Where everything, it was like whenever they tried to go deeper, it was like everything was covered with saran wrap. It was the weirdest thing. I could hear muffled voices. I could see things, but it was like I was inside of like a shower with privacy glass. Everything had that like warped refraction to it. It was really strange. And it's the first time that's ever happened where I wasn't able to go deeper in a session. And I've kind of been trying to figure that one out. So,
it could be that it's just something you're not ready to know yet.
Could be.
And it'll be made available to you at some point in the future.
Now, when it comes to that, when it comes to finding somebody to work with, because, It's a very personal situation trying to, at least for me anyway, trying to find somebody to do mediumship or to do psychic work with or even to do my remote viewing training with, you know, to have as a monitor. How do you recommend somebody find someone such as yourself, and how do you recommend they settle in with someone?
Well, you do have to be able to have a rapport with that person, and you have to. There's a lot of trust involved, both ways. And really, what it is, it all boils down to vibration as well. It's kind of like tuning an instrument. You've got to be playing in the same key, okay?
Sure.
Just as an analogy, with that person. And I think, you know, for me, when I do remote viewing training, esoteric training, I do all kinds of training and private readings, and it seems to be recommendations from other people for the most part, or if somebody just sees me on a show, they know they're supposed to be connected to me. And it always turns out that I'm able to do a really good reading for them, or they attend a class and they have results and, gain knowledge from it.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any coincidences. I think people are connected for reasons, and maybe they connect in one way and then it turns out to be an ongoing relationship.
Yeah, no, I definitely concur with that. That is something that we discuss on this show regularly, is the idea of vibration, the idea of connectedness. I mean, even right now, by all ninth grade science, Margie, we're sharing an electron shell. We are 90% empty space by all physics we know. So the idea of vibration, the idea of being able to understand via distance that quantum entanglement with somebody, that You'll know when the right person's there.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's a good way of explaining it. Of course, since you are the electronic nerd, as we were speaking of before, you use a little bit different terminology than I do, but I see it.
Yeah.
So I see the waves and the vibrations.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Well,
yeah.
It's kind of the idea that, you know, we live in a world of vibration. We are constantly swathed with it. Everything from Wi-Fi and RF to the entire world of cosmic radiation that we can't see that's right next to us. You know, we only mm-hmm. see like a 450 nanometer slice of the electromagnetic spectrum is what we see in here. So,
yeah, that's the hard part. When I'm trying to describe that, explain that to people, I use a visual slide for that so that they can grasp you know, what is really going on. There's a lot more going on in the world than just what we see with the eyes.
Well, and let's start getting into that, because you sent a few pictures from investigations that you've done. You sent a video of investigation that you've done. Let's start getting into those. We've got you for about another 30 minutes here, so.
Okay.
Let's start breaking into that a little bit. Let's see. One of the pictures that you sent was this interesting one.
Yeah, this was a strange thing that happened. This is actually an X-ray, and it's part of an X-ray. I don't know why it's only showing that part, but there was no hand in my back. This hand just showed up in the X-ray. My hands were down at the sides of this table.
Yeah.
And this showed up in my back. And the technician was so freaked out about it, she handed it to me and she said, get this out of here. I don't want to have it.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, if you've ever had an X-ray, of course, you know, like, they go behind a lead-lined wall.
Yeah.
Like, you would have lead all over you other than the place that's being targeted. Nobody is going to have their hand on your active back during an X-ray session, much less with what appears to be a ring on.
Yeah, it looks like two rings.
Yeah,
on this hand. And the thing is that I had the feeling it was my mother who had passed.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but I still to this day don't know for sure what that was. That's just a weird thing I thought I'd throw in for you.
Yeah, well, and, you know, it's one of those that, once again, looking at things from that angle, from that point of view of the things that we can't see that are all around us, that is beyond a smudge or anomaly on an X-ray. That is massive. That's huge. Like, that would have absolutely been a safety risk for anybody else in that room. You know,
well, there wasn't anyone else there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, it's pretty unusual. That's why I show it.
Now, you've sent another one here that appears to have something going in between you and the distance of a room in front of you.
Yeah,
looks like kind of a stairwell, something like that in the background.
There's a doorway to the right. Mm-hmm. That was our living room. And I was in that living room one evening by myself. And I saw a ball of light on the ceiling moving around, and then it shot out the door. And I turned to look to follow it, and I saw a full-bodied apparition of a man walk by and head right to that second door, which is our laundry room. And there is no staircase there that you see in that picture. There's not anything there. This is an apparition. And these other squiggles and stuff, you know, those are not normally there.
Yeah.
There was something there. And I'm thinking that before this house was built, I've remote viewed it and I saw a cabin there. And I think that was a staircase in that cabin. And then the second picture that you've got, which looks kind of similar, this was the second photo, and if you see, look, it looks like a hand is in front of the camera.
Yep.
And I had the distinct feeling that this entity did not want me to take its picture.
Wow. And did you understand why that was the case, or?
No, other than I felt like it was a male, and he wanted privacy, and he felt like that was his space, and he felt invaded.
And especially when, and that's something that I brought up pretty regularly on the show, especially when it comes to preparing for paranormal investigations. The idea of trying to blank slate things in your mind. It would be very hard for somebody who's heard this story, for instance, not to come to your house to investigate without thinking about the story, you know. But it's also the fact of, are we possibly charging an atmosphere with that thought form? You know, and in a way, shape, or form, kind of helping manifest that in a way.
Well, this male entity, and I believe it is the same one, has played pranks on us over the years. He's done some crazy things. You know, he'll go for years without doing anything, and then all of a sudden, doors will slam, or you hear his voice.
Oh, wow.
He did one trick one time. When my oldest daughter was 12 years old, she had her friend over, who was 12 years old. They both had sprained ankles and they had casts on. And so they were standing doing the dishes. I still made them do the dishes and they were laughing about it. Anyway, there was this is before we had our kitchen remodeled. And the cabinets were old and the bottom drawer, which is, you know, the big junk drawer, always stuck. So we always lifted about an inch out so you could get the thing open. And I looked down and I said, oh, who closed this drawer? And this man's really deep voice says, I did. And both of the girls looked at each other. They looked at me and they said, who said that? I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have each of us are going to watch each other. And I'm going to ask that question again. So I said, who closed this drawer? And the voice says, I did, only madder and louder, and none of us did it. Of course, we were females and we couldn't have done that deep voice. And so the girl who was spending the night threw down her dishcloth, called her mother and left and never returned. And so he did several tricks like that to us.
And, you know, we have one that I've had for years. That I have called Ent, short for entity, that does its playfulness, you know, where quite literally, and my wife has seen it a couple of times where I'll quite literally set something down and turn around to grab it. It's gone.
Well,
like just gone. We look for it. We look high and low. Like mm-hmm. I saw you put it down. And then we come back and it's right there. And man, it is, it's a strange thing when it happens. It's wild. And, once again, I am a firm believer of the fact that these worlds are directly adjacent to ours vibrationally. That these things are just out of reach, so to speak.
I agree. I think they're in one dimension above us. And when we raise our vibration to a certain rate, we can cross over a little bit. If they lower their vibration, they can cross over into our world and they can make things manifest and disappear and grab a set of keys and throw them across the room like I've seen, you know, and then they're gone. And it's almost like they get a burst of energy and they can do something for a minute, but then they can't anymore and they disappear. So there's never a long conversation with most of these entities, anything that has been in a human form and then passed on. I never have a long conversation with them. It's always short. But if it's an extraterrestrial or an interdimensional being that is not human, then the conversations can be long.
That is a really interesting point. And why do you think that is? Because I mean, by all rule of universal energy, you know, and energy conservation, at that point, you're pure energy. You would think it would take more effort for you to be in a physical form having a conversation. Why is it that it takes so much effort for a formerly living person to break through that veil, as opposed to another dimensional entity or an alien species, Marge?
Yeah, the only thing that I can figure is that they, for a human, that they need to gather energy in order to manifest or, you know, create some fog or make something move, but it's short-lived. And then they've got to go back to wherever they are and gather some more energy, or maybe grab some from your batteries or your, you know, your equipment or whatever. And some of them become very adept at it. So I wouldn't say that this is 100% across the board, because some of them can just, they can be there all the time. And there are some places that are very haunted that, you know, they have activity all the time. But most don't. Most, it's a fleeting thing. It's not common, but the only thing I can figure is, as far as the other types of entities having more energy and able to communicate for longer, is that they're in a still higher dimension, you know, sixth dimension and above.
Sure.
And they've got more control. They've got more knowledge. They're more advanced, much more intelligent, and maybe they have, you know, higher tech as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's the difference. The difference is probably knowledge and experience.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that. Like, that is one of the things that I have loved over the last year or so is to see the crossover of so many of these things. Once again, I think being brought about by topics like quantum entanglement that quite literally tie so many things together. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start looking at the way things can be influenced at a distance, things like that. Once again, everything from manifestation to perturbations in the world around us. I don't know if quite a bit of it isn't just kind of almost the old school concept of poltergeist, you know, the idea of like a teenage child with so much pent up energy that they don't even know that they're releasing it in that way. And I'm oftentimes brought to the thought form of, I wonder how much of that is actively happening because of the overactive world around us, you know, and how much of that are we generating?
Yeah, and you bring up a good point, because a lot of people and a lot of investigators are noticing that as of late, the last 2 or 3 years, there has been a lot more paranormal activity in all aspects. And so I'm thinking that this has to do with our thoughts and our feelings about what's going on in the world.
Sure.
The uncertainty, the stress level has gone up, kind of like that teenager that's, you know, got hormones going and they're creating things, a poltergeist. Yeah. We as adults may be creating these experiences as well and creating that type of energy just because of our stress level. I mean, look during COVID, how stressed everybody was. And then, you know, we've got the war looming and all of this other stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of energy going on. I mean, I even notice a personality change in people. You can just tell their stress level is super high.
I am one that I've even said it here on the show. Like I used to keep 10 balls in the air a day. Now it's a 3-ball show, and keep that hatchet and bowling pin to yourself, man. You know, like I my bandwidth is about a third of what it used to be, you know, and the lowering energy level, the lowering vibrational level of the world around us from that incident, from that worldwide pandemic, was something that I brought up throughout the entire time. Was like, we have to try to keep ourselves on the highest vibrational plane possible during this. You know,
because
otherwise, we will manifest horrible things in our own life.
We really do need to keep a positive attitude and ignore what's going on in the world, because we can't affect that.
Yeah.
All right, it's going to happen. Whatever dark entities are in the background running the show, you know, let them do their thing. You do your thing. Stay positive.
Yeah.
And help raise the vibration of everybody around you. Help raise consciousness.
Even over the last couple weeks with the eclipse madness going on, like I'm right here in the Texas Hill Country. We were square dab in the middle of it.
Oh yeah, we were too.
People like, oh, you know, oh my God, they're putting the National Guard out. And it's like, yeah, man, there's gonna be like an extra 100,000 people per town. What happens if everybody flushes the toilet at the same time? Like, there could be major problems if everybody decides to turn their air conditioner on at the same time, and there's an extra 100,000 people in Fredericksburg. You know, like you could crash a local grid doing stuff like that. So yeah, there were some common sense things, but it's interesting to see exactly how deep that rabbit hole got dug and how fast it got dug. You know, even with the idea of NASA launching a couple of satellites into the trail of the eclipse, it was like, you know, they launched those exact same satellites a couple years ago. And after the last, like during the last eclipse, There were no news headlines. There were no mass hysteria. What are they doing? You know, so it's interesting how easily we let ourselves get whipped into a frenzy and literally put these vibrations out there.
Yeah. They, you know, they fired up the CERN collider on that day. And boy, the stuff was flying about how they were demonic and they were doing ceremonies and then you look on YouTube and you see these weird costumes.
The guy who theorized Higgs and boson.
Yeah.
The particle died the day that they turned the collider back on.
Collider. Yeah. And then you listen to shows and they're talking about all these weird coincidences with the line of the eclipse and like 33 towns named Salem.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so people were ready for some big, huge thing. But, you know, every eclipse, the humanity thinks it's doomsday.
It's going to be the end.
Every eclipse in the history of mankind.
Since the beginning of time, it's now the apocalypse every time.
It wasn't the apocalypse.
It wasn't the apocalypse.
And everybody went back to everything they're doing the next day, just like normal.
Well, and you know, we've got you for about another 12 minutes, and I'd like to spend that last few minutes discussing gathering evidence in the field. And the idea of evidence, capital E, really we should say gathering data in the field, because as I say on the show regularly, evidence is what you give your lawyer to exonerate you. Like if I don't know if I'd call anything evidence if it wasn't the fact that I could give it to somebody and be like, this will set me free. You know, that's what evidence is. Aside from that, we've got some really interesting proof of anomaly. You know, even what you have and what you've shown here tonight, even the video that you sent me, which I will play right now as we chat, is fantastic proof of anomaly out there. And there is tons of that to be had. How does somebody go about, I guess, dispassionately looking at what they have gathered, Margie, and looking at it as data, you know, without getting overexcited, so to speak?
Well, it's hard not to get overexcited when you see something fantastic.
Sure.
You know, like a light turning on by itself in the middle of the night at, or early before anybody's in the office, and here, you know, this is a light coming on and an orb going through the kitchen of my old office. There wasn't anybody there at that time.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had another one, but the file was too big to send you. In that same office, my secretary was walking through to get the mail. She was like 2 feet away from this folded screen that I had, that at the time I used it for as my backdrop for my shows. Mm. And so I had it leaning up. It's heavy and it was folded. Well, she walked by it And even though she's but 2 feet away from it, as soon as she passed by it, it falls down on the ground and flips over completely on its own. There is no physical way that that could have happened. Even if she knocked it down, which she didn't, she wasn't near it, it would not have flipped over. And and that office is right next door to me right now. That building is so haunted. We've had apparitions show up. We saw a man standing on a roof one time when there was no man on the roof. We've seen him looking out windows. He's turned lights off and on, made unbelievable crashing sounds going down the steps that scared my daughter one evening so bad that she called the police to come investigate, and wow, there was nothing there. He's just real active. He's an angry, angry spirit who doesn't want anybody in that house.
And how do you handle a spirit like that? Whenever you're at an investigation, whenever something like that comes along, how do you deal with that yourself as somebody in the world of mediumship, Margie?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I do when I do an investigation. First, I remote view the site. So I know what is there. And before I go, and then they know I'm coming because now I've made a connection with this entity.
Interesting. Yeah.
And they know I'm going to be coming there. And so most of the time, these entities are simply people who have passed away, who have a connection to the property, and they feel at home there and they just want to be there. It's usually an older person. It could be a younger person, but they have a connection. Maybe they died in the house, whatever. But occasionally, and not very often, there will be a negative entity that's mm-hmm. made an attachment to someone in the house, or they really are, you know, like this, kind of like this guy that I've got in this one building, but occasionally worse than that, where you would call them evil. So I have the ability to ramp up my energy, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
would be the way I would explain it, and get rid of that entity. So, I mean, they know it even before I get there, and sometimes they'll be gone by the time I get there if I'm investigating another place.
The remote viewing of the location beforehand is very interesting, and I see that as, yes, a fantastic opportunity to kind of have that distance handshake in a safe way, you know, but before you do physically get on location where some sort of physical attacks, physical harm, things like that mm-hmm. could happen. Is there any kind of danger? And this is something that I want to approach from the remote viewing point of view here in the last couple minutes with you. But with people doing things like that, is there any kind of danger of them being harmed? What are the caveats yep. that somebody should take into consideration before doing such a thing, Margie?
See, when you're remote viewing, you are sending a part of yourself out, your yep. consciousness. And this is a physical thing. It's very light, but it is a physical thing. So you've already made contact with an entity. It's very important to do protection before you remote view anything, because you don't want to bring anything back with you. Now, is it easier for them to do it when you're there in person? Yes. It's easier for them to make attachments, especially for people who don't do protection. Mm. But it can be done with remote viewing too. So in my remote viewing classes, I always start out training people how to protect themselves from attachments.
Yeah. And that is a hugely important thing. Even whenever I had Kathleen Martin on talking about how they had their sessions with the Council of Eight, things like that. Even they had spiritual directors on site. Even they had somebody. Even somebody performing an exorcism has acolytes on site, you know, mm-hmm. somebody to help keep them spiritually in check. And they go through tons of preparation spiritually before stepping foot on location to handle an exorcism or anything like that. So,
oh, yeah, it's very important.
It is hugely important. So, and that's once again, a very important thing to discuss, which is why I wanted to bring that up with you here in our last couple minutes, because I always want people to do things with the most educated point of view. Margie, here on this show, we try to demystify things for our audience. We try and let them know that there are pluses and minuses to all of this. You know, it's one of those, like, you may think you want an experience with an extraterrestrial, but I've got a lot of books on these shelves. A lot of them don't really start off too well, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The people are okay with their experience typically come the end, but do you recommend people invite these things into their life? Do you recommend that
No, I don't. I think you let it happen naturally when it's supposed to, and when you're ready for it. You know, usually what happens is with ETs anyway, they'll make themselves known at a distance first. So you're looking up in the sky, you see something that you know can't be man-made. Okay, then you get some time to digest that. And then you may see something else. This might go on for a while. And then finally the person comes to the realization, yeah, we're not alone in the universe. Maybe I would like to meet an ET sometime. And then you're probably going to see something strange, but at a distance. But it's going to be an entity.
Yeah.
And no question. Or in some cases, while you're sleeping, they'll come to you in your dreams, or when you're halfway between sleep and awake, because that is the magic time. That's the time when your brain is at the right level of right level.
Yeah. Yeah.
In order to have that communication. And then you open your eyes and you see two ETs standing there.
Yeah. Mine was shadow people standing there.
Yeah,
we'll get into that another time.
But
you know, but that is a very interesting and special time, especially with your brain waves and the state that your brain is in. So that is a beautiful place for us to end things for this evening. Thank you so much for your time, chatting about these things tonight, for your candid information, especially when it comes to mediumship and talking with the other side. Before we let you go, of course, let everybody know where they can go to follow the UnX network, where they can go to like, follow, subscribe, all that kind of stuff, and where they can go to get a hold of you for personal sessions, Margie.
Okay, well, the UnX network is unxnetwork.com. That's the website. And yeah, there it is there. And that's got all the information about our shows, magazine, XCon coming up in October in Springfield, Missouri. And then as far as me personally, margiek.com, margiekay.com. And you'll see, you know, my appearance schedule, and you can sign up for a private session with me, private reading session, and see my list of books there.
Fantastic. And once again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your years of dogged work and research in the field, and especially your work at UnX. Networks like yours are so utterly important for getting these esoteric topics out there, for this renewal of mankind's spirit and mind. We are in a great burgeoning era of knowledge right now, and it's kind of scary, some of the pace at which it's moving. But at the same time, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to see so much knowledge being shared around the entire world, and with networks like yours popping up, sharing the right kind of information, sharing the good kind of information like you did tonight, where it is balanced and proper, and common sense based. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Take care. We'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff here in just a little while. So,
okay.
Take care. Fully appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was amazing, folks. Make sure to stop on by margiek.com. That is where you can find all of the books by Margie. That is where you can find all of her upcoming appearances. That's where you can go and schedule your personalized classes with her, your personalized sessions. Make sure to stop on by and check out UnX Network as well. UnXNetwork.com is that website. They have tons and tons of content, including our family member, Clyde Lewis, as well as other shows from Aftermath Media. So stop on by and check that out on UnXNetwork.com. Of course, while you're online, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That's where you can find all of our live content at CuriousRealm.com/live. And our Roku app also. If you are a Roku user, make sure to stop on by and download that free app. You will get not only all of our episodes and content, but you will also get hours and hours of free, yes, absolutely free, binaural beat music by yours truly. So stop on by and check that out, folks. When we come back from this quick break, we will be joined by Jason Quitt. Jason Quitt is the author of so many books, including the all new Gates of the Anunnaki. So we will be chatting with him about that, folks. We will be chatting with him about sacred alignments, about different esoteric traditions that have been carried down through the ages. We'll be talking with Jason Quitt right after this, everybody.
The Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for holding on through that quick commercial break. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my CBD of choice. We have worked with them for years and years as a sponsor. True Hemp Science is based right here in Austin, Texas. They provide amazing spigerically made CBD, some of the only CBD I've ever found with actual terpene profiles. So stop on by and check them out, folks. That is TrueHempScience.com. That is the website you want to visit. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to save $50 off your entire cart of, or 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more, and get 2 50-milligram edibles. So stop on by and check that out. And of course, while you are online, check out the website of our guest in this segment, Jason Quitt. His website is thecrystalsun.com. His new book is actually Gates of the Anunnaki. We are here to talk to him about the Epic of Gilgamesh, how the Epic of Gilgamesh leads to all kinds of sacred geometries and connections between past civilization and modern civilization. So welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. It's been a good couple weeks, good release, and happy that it's finally out into the world. So that we could talk about it and go down those rabbit holes.
And you know what I love is that the last time you were on the show, you were saying that you were getting ready to release this one, and then you were like, "But I also just started another one." So like you are nonstop with the research into this. And that is what I love about it, is that One Piece inspires you to go down another trail, and you just find so much information when it comes to archaeoastronomic alignments, all kinds of things, the way that these things are represented and carried forth throughout humanity in different sacred teachings and in different esoteric teachings. So what brought you to studying this to begin with?
Oh, it's a very large question. And I've always been interested in mysticism. I've always been interested in out-of-body experiences, and I love comparisons between different cultures, different spiritual texts. So this is kind of like where my study has been for the past 20 years. So I start going down some research path. Like I was just working on a book called The Egyptian Postures of Power, The Salute to the Moon. And so this is the original book, The Egyptian Postures of Power. And this, the next book is called The Salute to the Moon. And I'm always working on this book. I can't seem to finish the moon book ever. I've been trying to write it for years. And every time I'm writing a chapter on this book, I get some inspiration or I fall down a rabbit hole. And that's how I wrote the book Astral Genesis. It was actually a chapter from the book of The Salute to the Moon, where I was doing a comparison of the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the pyramid texts,
okay. And
how they relate to the as above, so below principle of the soul's journey through the afterlife, and how it relates to the sun's path through the Milky Way galaxy, and how they mirror each other. So it was almost like a diagram of basically how the cycles affect our lives and how the sun moves through the different constellations and how each star constellation represents a different god or a different motif, which was then stylized in very specific geometries, very specific stories that carried on into other spiritual texts later on. So as I was writing that chapter for the moon book, I realized that there's so much more to what I'm saying in this chapter that I just pulled the chapter of the book and expanded it into Astral Genesis. So then this year I said, okay, I'm going back to the moon book, and I'm starting to write it again. And I start going down the research path of the moon gods. And one of the oldest moon gods is a god called Nanna. And this is a Sumerian moon god that first shows up about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. And what's very interesting about Nanna is that he held a higher position than the sun, which I thought was very rare. Usually it's a solar motif. But in Sumeria, it was the moon god was the father of the sun. So it was a very powerful deity, and many stories and hymns were written about Nanna. And in Akkadian times, his name changed to Sin, but it's still the same god. Yeah. So there is this one text I was reading, because I always like to go back to the source material. And there's a text called The Herds of Nanna, which is a very ancient tablet that, you know, talks about how great Nanna is. And it talks about his houses or temples in the heavens. And he's known as the shepherd. His symbol is the horn, crescent, moon. He's the shepherd of bulls. So it has all this symbology related to Nanna. And because he's, you know, he is connected to the waters and fertility and the grass of the lands. And this is why herding animals are very important to moon goddesses or gods. But it talks about specifically in this hymn about these numbers. It starts listing all the different cattle that he owns in heaven. And he puts a number, a quantity of each cattle and where they're stored. And when I was looking at these numbers, it just hit me. These are very known numbers. Mm. I've written about these numbers before. And these numbers have to do with sacred geometry. They have to do with measurement of time and space and dimensions. And they're based off of Sumerian numbers. We get our numbers from ancient Sumeria when it comes to dimensions, time, and space. So when I took these numbers, I thought, okay, these are not really about cattle. This is like an allegory about a mathematical design or a mathematical code that's trying to be passed down. Because a lot of these ancient texts do that. They hide a lot of information in simple stories. So I said to myself, okay, let me see if I could try to find other tablets from Sumeria that continue this kind of motif where it lists numbers. And I found it in the Epic of Gilgamesh. I found it in the Herds of Nana. I also found it in the Sumerian Kings List.
Wow.
What we did was we broke down these numbers, and they also carry through. It wasn't just in Sumeria, Akkadian, or Babylonian. These numbers carried through into the Old Testament, New Testament. It carried through to Greek epics, Roman gods. Even in the Far East, these numbers are repeated in Hinduism and Buddhism. So these numbers are very important. And the question is, why? Why are these numbers repeated in these very ancient sacred texts going back 5,000 years, if not more? We don't know where this information originally came from. We don't know how old it is. So these are the mysteries that are in this rabbit hole.
And you know what's interesting to me is that, especially the fact that, yes, when it comes to our measurement of time, 60 seconds to a minute, 60 minutes to an hour, 24 hours to a day, all that kind of stuff, that all comes from ancient Mesopotamian Sumerian tradition. All of that number system comes from it. And when you start looking at things, especially like, once again, the idea of the recurring motifs of things like the moon, many ancient civilizations, the Mayans included, did not operate on a solar calendar. They operated on a lunar calendar because it was far more superior and accurate than a solar calendar. As a matter of fact, we didn't even use the solar calendar until we adopted the Augustinian calendar. Everything was on a lunar calendar until that point. And even whenever you start looking at later religions, like the Egyptians and the idea of, look at that, a bull god with a moon over its head. When you start looking at the religious Apis bulls from Egypt, things like that with, you know, once again, the same kind of imagery. These things, these motifs are repeated culture after culture after culture across the world. And it is remarkable when you start looking at that, when you start considering the literal realm of knowledge that is right there within our grasp that was obviously very accurate. We know that the star maps and the planetary maps that they had in ancient Sumer showed the other planets in the solar system long before we discovered them.
Yes, and even the gods were named after certain planets or certain stars. And the way to symbolize or personify these identities or this information was to create these epics or create these tales around these gods and use symbolism. So we always ask, you know, why is there serpent symbology? Mm. Why is there cows? Like, why is there a lion? You know, why are all these symbols used over and over again? What is so special about the horns in their alignment? You know, you're looking at, we're just passing this time of the year. If you look at the moon right now, at the new moon, when it has that first crescent, it's at the bottom of the moon. It's a perfect horned moon. And that is the basically the signal of life returning to the Earth. You know, fertility coming, vegetation starting to grow again. So it's the herding animals. It's the horns. So you have all this incredible symbology packed into these motifs. And we've lost this. We've completely lost these connections to the reason why they chose to symbolize or to personify these events in time or these cycles or these animals. And there's been a big disservice in the literalization of things.
Yes. Huge. Huge.
Where, and I feel like once we understand symbolism for what it is, which is to express an encyclopedia of knowledge through the symbol itself. That has to be taught, obviously, but the symbol is the book. It's the information that holds it through time. But in today's world, when we see all this chaos going around and you understand the ideology and the things that base these perspectives that we still live in today, is based off of things that were never meant to be taken literal.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, the prime example is the Epic of Gilgamesh. The Epic of Gilgamesh itself does not claim at any point to be an actual tale. Does not claim to be, you know, here is a factual account of what happened. It is just that. It is an epic. It is a poem. Now, granted, there have been many epics amongst time, and some of them have been proven to have absolute true parts to them. You know, go if you go back and look back at, let's say, like the epics that include the sacking of Troy. You know, it was considered mythology for millennia, for thousands of years, that Troy did not exist, that it wasn't an actual place, that it was part of Greek mythology, that the sacking of it was, until we actively found the remains of Troy, all of about 60, 75 years ago. You know, and that's just it. When you start looking at things, especially even the fact that a while ago you mentioned houses, and let's explore that for a minute, because I think that that is, and this is where your work and the work of Micah Denk really kind of come together. The idea, and I love it whenever I see you guys on social media keying in on each other with these things, because like right now, the state of Israel, the Israeli church is getting ready to have the red heifer sacrifice. They ordered their red heifers from Texas years and years ago. And they have found the person who is, clean enough ritualistically to be able to take the sacrifice. And we are coming up on the time of the bull in the zodiacal calendar, which is when it has to happen. And it's interesting to see that even the Jewish faith is following something. They're on a lunar calendar as well, not a solar calendar, which is why they have a totally different date system in traditional Judaism. And in addition to that, once again, very zodiacal in the way their calendar moves. And when you start looking at the timing of this red heifer ceremony, it is, oddly enough, right as we are coming into the time of Taurus. And these things, it's interesting to see them referring to houses back then. And I think the zodiac is probably the closest thing we have now, which even in and of itself is still adulterated.
See, if we take this idea, which you just put forward, it comes from an earlier time. All right. So when you're talking about the bull and bull sacrifices, this is the time of the age of Taurus, which is about 4,000 years ago. Now, Hathor, which is Ra's counterpart, the goddess Hathor, she is also known as the cow. the red cow, and she is basically brings in the spring and the summer. All right. So in the Bible, we're talking about the sacrificing of the golden calf or the bull. That was done in an earlier time period. This is why in the Bible, when this is, they go to, when they, oh man,
it's a big one. It's a big one, man.
But when they go to Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments and they build the golden calf, as an idol to be burned or sacrificed or prayed to, they destroy it because they left the age of Taurus and it became the age of Aries back then. So it was all about the sacrificial lamb and the lamb's blood on the doors.
Yep.
You know, so it switched from Taurus, the bull, to Aries, the ram. And this is where the space of Judaism came from. And then when Jesus came, he was known as the fish, you know, and so you're sacrificing the fish god, you know?
Yeah.
And
the symbol of the ichthys.
Yes. So you have all these kind of motifs that continue forward during the changes of the ages. And this is where we're at today, where we think that – so where does the red color come from?
Mm.
All right. They're burning or they're sacrificing the bull during the sign of Taurus or the house of Taurus. And what's on the opposite of Taurus? It's Scorpio. All right. And Scorpio is known for a red star called Antares. So when the sun moves in front of the Taurus, that's what we're going into. When the sun moves in front of Taurus, the sun makes Taurus disappear. So the motif is the bull is sacrificed because you cannot see it anymore because the sun is in front of it. But now when we look up into the heavens, you're going to see Scorpio and you're going to see the red star coming, which is the star of spring and summer. It's the same as Hathor bringing in the red Hathor, bringing in spring and summer.
Yeah. And once again, a huge point of Jewish prophecy, a huge point of Jewish tradition that they have considered for a long, long time. So to see this coming to fruition right now in our lifetime is really interesting. And once again, a prime example of how these alignments, how these archaeoastronomic alignments known since then reflect nowadays and how they are still important to our faiths. I mean, even Catholic Easter floats around the equinox. Like it depends on when the equinox is as to when Easter and Lent is. You know?
It follows the sun, it follows the moon.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that in the Bible they teach us we're not allowed to follow astrology.
Mm. Yeah.
We're not allowed to follow the signs in the skies or whatever. Like now, they put an end to that. But before that, it was all about that.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I just had this conversation. I have this conversation on this show regularly, and I am somebody, even as a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, willing to have this conversation with anybody that'll want to have it. You start reading those big red words and you go through and you start reading some Kabbalah. As somebody who studied to be a Roman Catholic priest, one of the many psalms that we read regularly and that is read at the ordination of priests is the one about being a priest in the order of Melchizedek of old. Now, what that means, folks, is one of the high priests of Israel, one of the people that wore the chest plate and were able to touch the Ark of the Covenant, the people that were the conduit between man and God. Now, what you had to do in order to get to that conduit was go to the temple, purchase a dove or a larger animal outside, change your money first, of which the temple got part of that money, and then you went and you sacrificed an animal. The larger the animal, the more expensive the animal, the better the sacrifice, the more pleasing it was to God. So welcome to the system of being poked by the plate. You want to know why the guy started turning over tables? There you have it. And it's interesting how, yeah, they weren't really upset. It was really much more the fact of he was giving away the mystic tradition of the high priests to the common people and teaching them that they no longer needed that conduit of a Holocaust sacrifice in order to talk to the divine, that they were taking part in the divine every day and that they were partially divine. And that's dangerous when you're talking about trying to keep a paradigm going and trying to keep money in the coffers, you know? And that's what's there. That's what's in those big red words. If you start reading them and kind of subtract everything else and start looking at it from Jewish mystical priestly tradition, he was giving, and it makes a lot of sense when you start seeing, like, why would the high priests of Israel be listening to a 12-year-old? Because they didn't believe that he was the son of God. But if he was a advanced Kabbalist student, darn tootin', they'd be listening to him. So it makes a lot of sense. And he gives away a lot of Kabbalistic tradition and teaching in his teachings.
Yeah, and even the words ka, ba, and la is ancient Egyptian. Ka, the astral body, the light body. The ba is the personality,
yeah,
and the identity. And the la, if you go and open up your Egyptian Book of the Dead, la is the moon god.
Mm. Interesting. You
know, many people don't know that.
Well, and you know, even going back, start looking back at the fact of Moses was brought up in the court of Egypt. He definitely had knowledge of the high priests, things like that. He had knowledge of sacred tradition. Arks existed all over the place in Egypt. You know, like even the size and the concept of the Ark of the Covenant itself wasn't an original concept or idea. So it's interesting to see how these things are passed along and moved along. Even the idea of when you start looking at the motions of the mass of the Catholic Church, it's basically, you know, the Shabbat Supper. It's you know, it comes straight out of High Judaism and Jewish temple to begin with. Even the order of Mass follows just about the same thing.
They all have their ties.
Yeah,
I mean, they're the way that I look at it is they're all children of each other, and it's just kind of like passing down a tradition, but then kind of making it their own.
And also at the same time, kind of pushing away the previous tradition, because I mean, even if you've got Islam, Judaism, and Christianity all claim Abraham as the spiritual father, you know,
that's right.
They all claim Moses as a prophet. So, it's interesting when you start seeing those similarities, when you start seeing the similarities in belief, teaching, all of these things, and in the way that these things are even passed down, even the idea that most of those things were passed down only to those that were initiate in the priestly order, even the idea of hieroglyphs. Hieroglyphs were not the language of the common person. They were a sacred language used and written, not necessarily a spoken language.
And this is also how things were kept separate. So you had the different castes of people.
Yeah.
And you would have to be initiated into this knowledge. And this is basically what I'm trying to show in these books, is that you can get a story, let's say like the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is incredible, and it's passed down for thousands of years, and it's influenced biblical texts that we still look at today. But when you start to break down the Epic of Gilgamesh, you start to see these motifs and themes that have very deep symbolic knowledge in them. So they were put in there for very specific purposes. But if you're just reading it as someone who doesn't understand the symbology or was not initiated into this knowledge, you just read it as an epic, as a tale, and you know that it's great in that way.
Yeah.
But once you go through the breakdown and understand why they're saying this, why did they put those numbers? Why are they telling them to build this thing? Why are they going during this time? Why are they eating at this table? You know, all of these things have significance. So they're very deep. They're very deep. And this is the kind of the perspective that I want to start sharing with people, is that these stories are not just stories. They're packed with information that is supposed to be passed down through the generations. And they have. We're still talking about it. We're still looking at it. There's many interpretations. There's many beliefs around these deities, these stories, these locations. And in fact, we wouldn't have even known about Sumeria. And we wouldn't have even known about these things only a couple hundred years ago, not even a couple hundred years ago. They wanted to prove the Bible was real. And this opened up archaeology. So they went to Iraq, they went to ancient Mesopotamia, and they started digging to try to find these cities that were talked about in the Bible so that they can prove that the Bible was real. But they also found these tablets. So they did prove that these locations and these cities, just like Troy, are real cities buried in time. But then when they dug up the tablets and started reading it, they realized that a lot of the stories are identical to what was later adopted in, let's say, the Old Testament or the New Testament, which there you find a conundrum.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even in the adoption of the Old Testament, and that is an important thing to consider, Jason, because once again, these tales, these stories were given very much in the same way as Aesop's fables. Almost where this is how you convey a moral lesson.
Yes.
This is how you convey a teaching. And to those who are initiate, yes, very much the same way as going through and reading an alchemical text. You know, if you are initiate to the philosophic form of that text, you draw a lot more out of it than the average person just reading a text, you know? And you understand that what they're talking about isn't necessarily a chemical process, but a spiritual one, and one of purifying yourself and, you know, finding your own philosopher's stone to purify into gold, which is you, you know,
that's right,
intrinsically. And these texts do the same thing. And we as people, even as a biblical student, I would challenge anybody. Why are there two stories of creation back to back? One is Mesopotamian and one is Sumerian. Like they aren't even really woven together. It says first story of creation, second story of creation. Doesn't matter which version of the Bible you read, King James or, you know, a Catholic Bible, that doesn't matter. They all say first story, second story. There's two different stories back to back. So which one is, if you're talking, it's all absolute fact, which one? Which one? The one where we are made from clay and man and woman are created together at the same time, or the one where God takes a rib from man and makes Eve? Because they're two different traditions, two different stories, and it happened to be that both of them, the Jewish people, spent time with. You know? So it's like, hey, here is our understanding of it. Here is what we know to be the creation story. And here's another tribe saying, well, we're from over here, and this is what we know to be the creation story. A lot of similar motifs between them, but a few huge differing facts, much like the idea of the Ten Commandments, where it says, thou shalt not kill. But all of a few chapters in the Bible later, this whole tribe of Israel and their children and their descendants, they just need to go. They need to be gone. And that's the order from the exact same God who just said, thou shalt not kill. Except those dudes. Kill all of them.
And so, and this is the other yeah. thing is like, many people in this community come here because of Zachariah Sitchin.
Absolutely.
And they love that epic tale of the Anunnaki. When I started to read the different tablets myself, not from his books,
sure.
You realize that there's not one creation story. There's multiple creation yes. stories, and it's from different locations and then different time periods. Even though it's from like the Sumerians, the Akkadians, the Babylonians, they have the same gods, same names, they kind of shift, but the stories yeah. have fundamental differences to them. So then I say, how do you choose which one is the one that's absolute fact and then disregard the rest? You know, you have to look at them and see what are their similarities. It's really interesting. And if you read the very popular ones, like the one with Atrahasis, which is very similar, or the one that Zachariah Sitchin talks about, where they create man to take the labor of the gods. Basically, a demigod offers his life as a sacrifice, and the blood of that god was then used to mix with clay to create mankind, right? But if you go to the yeah. Babylonian tale, which is the Elnum Elnish, I can never pronounce that properly.
That's all right.
But if you go to that epic tale, this one is crazy. It talks about how Marduk wins the war against Tiamat, killing her, creating heaven and earth, and that he kills all the demons that she created. And he saves the king demon, which his name is Kingu. So he saves the king demon, the most vicious, you know, demon that Tiamat created. And he sacrifices the demon and uses the demon's blood to create humans to toil in the fields and work for the gods.
Interesting.
So it's really interesting that one story is like a demigod, you know, gives himself up to create humankind to, you know, yeah. lessen the work of the gods. And this one is, you know, this is Kingu's demon's blood that were used to create.
Absolutely. And much like when you go through and start researching the Nephilim and yes. the concepts of the Nephilim and where those teachings come from, a lot of that is obscured and a lot of it is contradictory even to itself, you know, not saying that the Nephilim weren't there or that they aren't a full teaching in many, many cultures, many, many religious traditions. However, once again, I'm a former Catholic seminarian. I am fully willing to accept, the issues that are there in the Bible. And if you aren't, there's a problem. Because there's a lot of problems there. And there's a lot of things to, yes, take not necessarily as story, but to take with a grain of salt and to understand that these were moral teachings coming as best as possible from an ancient tradition through modern word and through modern concept, you know?
And once you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, you know, from that perspective, the yeah. first paragraph slaps you in the face. Because what does it talk about Gilgamesh? One, he's a giant. He's a demigod, two-thirds god, one-third human.
Yep.
It talks about how he takes all the women for himself. And this is the struggle. This is why the humans were going against the god, going against Gilgamesh. They go to Anu in heaven and they beg him to create Enkidu, which is the twin or brother or exact opposite of Gilgamesh, to bring peace to the world so that Gilgamesh, stops stealing and taking the women for himself, which is exactly what the Nephilim were described in the Bible as.
Absolutely. I mean, that is why the earth was flooded. The earth was flooded because they took wives of the women of men and had children. So pretty much the exact same thing. And once again, even to know that neither one of these traditions, none of the ancient traditions, Babylonian, Mesopotamian, Sumerian, none of those, nothing was monotheistic until we came to the point of Zoroaster. Zoroaster was really the first one to say there is a division here between good and evil. And there is a representation of good, a representation of evil. Until then, it was multiple gods, demigods, all kinds of things roaming around that influenced man, that partook with man, that walked the earth with man, talked with man, all kinds of things. And to see these traditions carried forth, this is a lot of where we get the tradition of angels and ranks of angels and things like that, Jason.
Absolutely. And you kind of see this evolution. So when you're studying these ancient texts from Mesopotamia and going back to Sumeria, you see this evolution of basically the hierarchy of heaven, or the hierarchy of the gods, the higher gods and the lesser gods. And originally, they were divided into, I would say, they represented or personified natural phenomenon. So it was kind of like they were trying to describe the creation from the absolute void, because the creator gods, or the gods that brought, you know, the first gods, were the gods of the abyss, the gods of the dark waters. This is Absu, Tiamat. In Egypt, this is the god Nun, which is the god of the dark waters, where everything is the void, the space. And from the space, you get the first aspects of light coming forth through it, and so on and so on. So you have this hierarchy of this division of creation. So it's a creation story based on personifications of deities. For example, like Nana is the god of the moon. Utu is the god of the sun. Ishtar is the god of the planet Venus. You know, so they all represent aspects of the physical world and how they influence the physical world. And over time, you see a switch where you have these great epics where they place basically these savior gods. And one of the best examples of these savior gods is Marduk. Or Mardu from the Babylonian creation story, where basically, you know, the gods basically rebelled against heaven. This is where the whole rebellion story comes from.
Yep.
Is the Babylonian story is they're rebelling against Absu and Tiamat, because Absu and Tiamat are very upset with the lesser gods because they cause too much noise. They can't sleep. So these are the gods of the void, the gods of the darkness, of the dark waters. They want to sleep. They want to continue to be in their slumber. They don't want to be disturbed by the lesser gods who are now making noise and chaos in the universe. And so they go out to say, you know what? We're going to put a stop to this. We're going to kill all the gods. And then when the gods figure out that that's the plan, they rebel. And the one who steps forward is Marduk. And he kills Absu, you know, he kills the abyss, and he kills Tiamat. So he becomes the savior, and then all the lesser gods look up to Marduk, and he becomes the savior of the universe. So I think this is like the first instance where suddenly you have, you know, Marduk is exalted over all the gods because of what he did.
Yep.
And that's pretty late in the game. That's the Neo-Babylonian version. So this is right before Old Testament, maybe a couple hundred years before Old Testament.
Yeah.
And I think this lays the groundwork, and it really does lay the foundational work to these stories that came afterwards.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, once again, that was the time of the Babylonian exile. Everything else, that is when the Jewish people were living in Babylon. So to have picked all of that up, to have had the prophet Ezekiel, which was just before that time, was just before Ezekiel, where the prophecies of the one who would come, the one who would come to free us, the one who would come to stop the darkness. And I just had up on screen a minute ago, Genesis 1:2, the earth was formless and void, an abyss, you know, like that. That was the tradition straight up for just about every single ancient society, is the fact of all of these things came from the darkness.
If you go to my book, The Egyptian Postures of Power, I actually did a side-by-side comparison of Genesis and the words of Genesis of the creation and the hierarchy of the gods of Egypt. And as you go line by line, it actually shows you that it's the same hierarchy of these formulas of creation that are expressed through each god or each division from the void into creation. It follows that same motif. Maybe different, and it's not even different words, you know.
No,
it's just
not
said
really.
In different ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. Once you start down, much like you, once you've started down this rabbit hole of information, it's not. It doesn't take long to start finding these things, and it can be hard for it not to just envelop everything. It can be hard for it not to be like you, where it's like, I'm in the middle of researching one book and completely wrote another book.
Yes.
You know, like I just couldn't put it all in one chapter because there's just too much. And we regularly have Stephen Myers on, things like that. He talks a lot about, you know, actual technologies that may have built the pyramids aside from UFOs coming down and giving us the technology. And it's like, you know, that is almost not saying that that is not within the realm of possibility. Very well could be. But I think it also subtracts a lot from the ingenuity of humanity and from the knowledge that our ancient ancestors had. You know, the knowledge of standing wave frequencies, the knowledge of how our brains react to frequencies and why their sacred spaces are the sizes and dimensions that they are, that oddly enough happen to amplify those frequencies. These are things that we have just discovered. And when you start looking at ancient Minoan society, Egyptian society, rings of Stonehenge, all of these locations have these properties.
We even have Coral Castle today.
Yep.
Where the person who built it basically said that he had figured out the secrets of the pyramid builders.
Yeah.
Didn't share that knowledge, but he demonstrated it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, these things are being discovered regularly. They are out there, and there are tons and tons of resources. And I am so glad that you are out there, Jason, as one of those resources, because the work that you have done in this series of books is so entirely clean. And what I love is that you much like Stephen Myers, his whole thing is the Orion correlation theory. And the idea of correlation is not causation. Just because something correlates doesn't mean that's the source of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you very much are in the same vein. You very much are in the fact of, no, let's look at this from a factual point of view. Let's remove religious passions of it, you know, and be willing to look at the absolute connection between these things. I mean, even the fact of houses, once again, to bring it back to the beginning of the conversation, the fact that houses were referred to in that astrologic language back then and we still have the same kind of language now for the same purposes.
And it was very clear back then.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a mystery back then. When they were talking about the different gods in the different houses, they were talking about the sun moving into different constellations in the zodiac.
Yeah.
And they would be changed in form. So, for example, one of the examples I put in the book was the god Enki at his gate. And Enki is in the form of a goat with a fish's tail, which is the symbol of Capricorn.
Yep.
And what is Capricorn? It's the winter solstice. It's the beginning of the wet season. And Enki is pictured with water coming out of his shoulders. He is the god that represents water, the bringing of water to earth during the wet season. So it was abundantly clear back then what that represented and what that was.
Yep. Yep. And once again, the fact, like we say regularly on the show, our ancestors had these different views because they had a different view, period. They actively had a view of the night sky. We rarely get to see these things cross across the night sky in the grandeur in which they do in a modern day and age. But my grandfather knew when to go hunt. He knew when to go hunt because his grandfather knew when to go hunt, and they knew when to go hunt because of where Orion was in the sky in relation to the time of year, things like that, you know? These were things that regularly decided when you put seed in the ground, when you harvested that seed. This is what you lived and died by. It wasn't just something that you hung up on the wall like we do now. If you didn't know this, if the high priest of your area didn't know this, and you didn't listen to him, you may not make it through the winter.
We call it symbology today. But back then, it was maps of survival.
That's right. That's right.
So you had to know these things. So we come, like you just said it perfectly, we come to this from a completely different perspective because we're trying to place this knowledge in our era of time and our era of thinking, which you cannot do.
Nope.
And you'll never figure it out and you'll never understand if you're putting it through the lens of today.
That's right.
Just like how they can't see what we understand. Can you describe a Simpsons episode and why it's funny to someone 4,000 years ago?
50 years ago.
Yeah.
50 years ago, I would give you, you know, because those things change. Those change with the social mores and morals of society. You know, what was funny in Shakespeare's time, you look at it now and it's like, you got to explain why it was funny.
Yes.
You got to explain why a comedy of errors is funny.
And the thing is, we don't realize, but we're still doing the same thing that we've done for thousands of years, which is tell stories that have moral, tell stories that have morality, and tell stories that give a glimpse of the culture. So like if you're looking at, let's say, the DC universe or the Marvel universe, the Avengers, Superman, all these things, we're actually placing our cultural understanding, our cultural wisdom and tying it to these ancient motifs that have been playing out for thousands of years. And we're still doing it today, even though we don't realize it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just it. You know, good people have gone through and figured that out. You know, when you start looking at a lot of modern philosophic teaching, things like that, like this is where we get the ideas of Star Wars and, you know, once again, the ideas of Superman, even in and of itself, comes from a conglomeration of these teachings of ancient civilizations and modern philosophic teaching.
Yes.
Of the Superman.
Yeah, and we have these stories ingrained in us, and we continue to evolve them and continue to adapt them to our place in our time. And that's what makes us human.
That's right.
I think it's the greatest survival thing that we have, because we can now pass that information down generation to generation so they can build off of that knowledge that we placed into it.
Yes.
The thing that I find so incredible is how deep these ancient stories actually are. The more I go through them and the more information that comes out of them, it's so deep that the mind or the minds of the people who originally put these stories together must have been incredibly smart, incredibly gifted, taught by the best, is all I can say.
Yeah.
For it to survive this long.
And for it to have the information that it has literally encoded in it. I'd love to say that it didn't encode it, but it's one of those, like, the information's right there. You just have to kind of know what the information is and what you're looking at, you know? No different than an astrological map of the sky, you know? Somebody recently asked me, like, how do you know how to find all of these deep space objects that you take pictures of, man? It's like, because I know how to read a sky map.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you know how to read a key map, you will never be lost in any city in the United States, because you can get a key map of it and you will get it down to the block, man. You know, but you have to know how to read a key map.
And this goes to a perfect example of the Kabbalah, is that let's say you're growing up as a biblical scholar. You're only able to be taken into Kabbalah at the age of 30.
Yep.
So you don't know the full story until you're 30 years old. And why is 30 so important? Jesus was baptized at the age of 30. You know, why is these numbers 30 keep coming up? Because when you reach the age of 30, that is the official date that you stop growing. Okay, so you've reached your physical peak at 30. And then from 30 years old down, you start to decline physically. But your spirit starts to awaken at the age of 30. Mm. You know, so it is like this, the second baptism of life you get at 30. It's the spiritual time of life that you grow your spirit.
Yeah.
And that's when you get read in and initiated into what we're talking about.
Yeah, no, precisely. And that's just it. All these things used to be part of initiation. They were all part of either a cultural or spiritual initiation and coming of age. And I'll be honest, we are very immature as a society nowadays, Jason. A mature society does not diminish people for what they think, for what they believe, does not, feel the need to change somebody's want of belief. Even whenever you look at ancient Rome, other ancient cultures that came in, the wise ones, sure, they may have built a temple or two to their gods there, but they allowed the local religion to continue. They allowed the local culture to continue because they realized that was what was important to those people, was keeping that alive, you know. And if anything, they did, well, kind of like the Catholic Church did, where they'd be like, oh, wow, you have this thing called Ishtar about this god of rebirth? Cool. Look at that. We have a thing that we have called Easter, where our dead god rises from the grave. You know, very much the same thing. We should have them at about the same time. You know, and that's where we end up today. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize that, yes, there was a lot of usurpation of these things by religion, by mainstream religion, by my religion. They were fully usurped, fully brought in, no different than Dia de los Muertos. And the idea of All Saints Day, All Souls Day, you know, very much the same thing. So we do this all the time in culture. We do this all the time throughout humanity. And your book, Gates of the Anunnaki, is absolutely amazing, man. I want to thank you first off for sending me an advance copy. The copy, and the color is what I love, because you actually include color illustrations of things, all that kind of stuff, to show these angles and the way that these things are connected throughout history, and the way that these esoteric teachings have carried forth even into modern day society. So thank you so much for your reams and reams of research. I can't wait to see what the new book has coming forth. Let everybody know where they can go to keep up with your work, where they can go to order the books, where they can go. You're actually appearing at Contact in the Desert coming up. So, yeah, I know you don't know your booth number yet, but tell us a little bit about Contact and everything else, bud.
Sure. Well, this year in Contact, it's going to be the first time where I'm going to be presenting Gates of the Anunnaki.
Awesome.
So I'm going to be working on that presentation now till then. And, you know, I can't wait to share that information with everybody. I'm also going to be doing a talk on experiencers and a talk on the Egyptian postures. You could also find me at the Crystal Sun. That's my personal website where I got lots of crystals and books and things of that nature. And, or you can find it very easily on Amazon.com. And I'm on Twitter as well.
Awesome.
I'm mostly active on Twitter.
Awesome.
Under Jason_Quit.
Well, fantastic, man. Thank you so much for your time as always. It's great chatting with you. It's great catching up. Once again, your work is just on point. So fantastic. I love your work. We need to do a session sometime with you and Michael Dank. Because to hear you two guys bounce off of each other would be incredible, to say the least. So,
yes,
this stuff is so amazing, and I could talk about it for hours. So, hold the line real quick while we close things out for the audience. Thanks so much again for all your incredible work in the field, as well as your time today, Jason.
No, thank you for having me.
You bet. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Jason Quit over at thecrystalsun.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can, of course, find the Curious Realm store, where you can find all of the guest books, all of the guest videos, classes, things like that. Also, don't forget, we now have an official Curious Realm app. If you are a Roku user, stop on by the App Store and download the official Curious Realm app. You will get not only all of the episode content, but also tons of binaural beat meditation music made by yours truly, like hours worth. So stop on by and check that out if you're a Roku user, everybody. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not move forward. We just kind of sit here spinning wheels. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, as well as KPNL Radio, APR TV, and the Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit groundzeromedia.org and aftermathmedia.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.